Good morning.
Good morning.
This is my first Sunday Dharma talk, so thank you for all coming. My subject today is about why is Marty such a goofball?
I'm so afraid of that.
I could go on for a long time. Actually, this is true for all of us. The subject could be, why are we all such goofballs? Or more importantly, why do we need to be? Actually, the subject of my Dharma talk today is about home leaving. Specifically, home leaving in a Buddhist sense. And this is something I've been thinking about a lot lately for a number of reasons. One of which is I'm watching my wife Nancy sew her robes in preparation for her home leaving ceremony. It's the 2-year anniversary of my home leaving ceremony, which took place here just 2 years ago this past November. And it's also the anniversary of an event, home leaving of sorts for me, that happened 40 years ago actually to this very day, that was to have a profound effect on me and is probably one of the reasons why I am sitting before you here now. So if I have some time at the end of the talk, I'll share that with you. I'll just throw that out there as a teaser for now. Of course, maybe you won't be paying attention to the talk if you're wondering what the heck that was. So home leaving is traditionally thought of as marking the beginning of the Buddhist path, or at least as marking a formal commitment to a lifelong serious practice. Of course, home leaving in a literal sense is something that we are all familiar with, because it's something we do all the time, starting with our birth, right? And that's kind of a home leaving. You know, sometimes easy, sometimes not. My own particular birth was a breech birth, and my mom has been saying I've been doing everything half bottom backwards ever since. But when you think about it, you know, after birth, you know, you leave home right away. I mean, birth itself is a home leaving. Just when you get comfortable after 9 months, you have to leave home. And then you leave the hospital. And then you go home to mom and dad's house, and before you know it, you're leaving the crib. You know, you're crawling about, you're walking, and then it's off to kindergarten, off to school, and so on. There's just one home leaving after another. You can't wait to do that when you're a kid. Get your first car. Our youngest son, Jacob, just got his driving license. And so he's doing more home leaving than ever before. And it's off to college, jobs, marriage, or marriages. Eventually we leave the various stages of our life. We eventually leave life, the ultimate home leaving, at least as far as our experience this time around goes. I was thinking, as I was thinking about the moves in my life, I counted up, I moved my residence 17 times in my lifetime so far. Wow, I should be getting good at this. So we're always leaving home. Sometimes these home leavings are planned, sometimes they're unexpected. Sometimes they are joyous or sad, sometimes even tragic. We may mark our home leavings with a ceremony or a rite of passage, a ritual, a public remembrance. In Buddhism, home leaving, like I said, traditionally marks the beginning of the Buddhist path. And here at the Zen Center, in the Japanese Zen tradition, this is called shuke, which means home leaving. And this marks the ordination of someone formally entering the Zen Buddhist priesthood. when we do this, I don't know how many of you have attended a shuke ceremony, but it's a beautiful ritual rooted in the Japanese Zen tradition, going back many hundreds, if not a thousand years or more. Some of elements of the shuke ceremony go all the way back to the time of the Buddha. And the ceremony is filled with symbolic gestures and chants and external tangibles, you know, such as shaving your head or getting a new name, getting, in our case, a black rakusu, a set of way cool robes to wear. Then you can wear samoe, all of which these things kind of signify you've kind of left home, at least an external thing, so that people can look at me and say, Chris has left home. He's still wearing his pajamas, but he's left home, and that's cool. So home leaving comes up a lot in Buddhism. So much so, in fact, I can't help but wondering if there's something more to this than simply a rite of passage. And that's what I kind of want to talk about today. And I think this is what Dogen is pointing to in one of the fascicles from the Shobo Genzo called Home Leaving Shuke, a quote from which is on the bulletin today. I'll read that for those of you who don't have the bulletin. He says, when someone learns what a Buddha is and drops off whatever that person is holding on to, such a person is, in this way, an excellent example of leaving home life behind and accepting the precepts. So if home leaving was just a rite of passage, that's all it was about, I find myself wondering, why would Dogen be addressing an assembly of monks in this way? This talk was given to monks in a Heiji monastery way up on the northwest coast of Japan in snow country, far away from everything. They may have not had really any other people there other than ordained monks. So these are all people who left home. So why say this? There seems to be something deeper, I think, more essential in this Buddhist concept of home leaving. So I think the significance of home leaving here in Buddhism does not so much have to do with a rite of passage as it does with a state of mind. And it's this home leaving mind, if I may call it that, that has much to do with Dogen's concept of continuous practice. So what is this home leaving and why is it important? Well, the story starts, of course, with the Buddha. Actually, even before the Buddha, as home leaving was traditionally a part of Indian spiritual practices in ancient India of the Buddha's day, people would shave their head, don the robes of a mendicant, have a begging bowl, and go wandering around in search of the truth, the meaning of life. So we tend to think of the Buddha's story as starting with such a home leaving, the big home leaving that he does when he's 29, when he leaves his wife and child in the middle of the night. But in fact, the Buddha's story, if you think about it, is also a story of multiple home leavings, much like our own, starting with his birth, followed very closely by the death of his mother when he's about 12. We hear a story about him sitting under the rose apple tree during the spring plowing festival, and he significantly leaves home in kind of a really important way, which I'll come back to, because I think that has a lot to do with what the Buddha made of home leaving later on. But the next time we hear about home leaving is when he takes these forays out into the city. Supposedly he hadn't seen anything of the outside world, and he gets his driver's license and his charioteering license, and off he goes, and he has these four fateful encounters. He sees sickness, he sees old age, he sees death, and he sees a peaceful, wandering mendicant, which has a profound effect on him, eventually then leading to this big home leaving, where he leaves his wife and kid, his family, his responsibilities as the future leader of his clan. He leaves all that in the middle of the night. And we think of that as his home leaving, but doesn't really stop there, because he goes on to go through a series of teachers, which he also leaves. He explores a number of practices, which he leaves. He starts hanging out with some ascetic buddies in the forest, who he also leaves. So it's leaving, leaving, over and over again. Eventually, on the point of death, where he's the next home leaving is clearly going to be leaving his body and this life. You know, and he says, okay, there's got to be another way. And he sits under a tree, and he vows not to leave that spot until he has figured things out, until he is fully awakened. Of course, while he's sitting there, there's all kinds of things that come up, portrayed graphically in the story of the Buddha's life, temptations to lure him away from his seat, lure him into another home, as it were, or scary things, armies of demons and zombies, politicians that scare him to run away from home. So, but he stays, and he has this great awakening, which, interestingly, is, I think, this is my interpretation, it's kind of like the ultimate home leaving. And he declares, with this ultimate home leaving, this is, house builder, you have now been seen. You shall build the house no longer. All your rafters have been broken, your ridge pole shattered. You will not build this house again. But I talk about a home leaving. This time he's not leaving home. This time it's the house, the home that is recognized for what it is. Something that's always falling apart. So the Buddha realizes this. Home, whatever form that takes, is not a solid, permanent, fixed abode. It never has been, never can be. So the problem isn't so much the house, really. It's not the home. It's trying to make a permanent abode of it. Something that's doomed from the start. So this time, by the time the Buddha gets up from his seat, he truly, I think, has left home. And this time, he's not looking for a new address. Although, interestingly, as almost like a last parting shot from somewhere deep in his mind, we would say Mara, there comes this temptation of maybe just hang out in this complacency of the bliss of this realization. You know. But he doesn't. That would make a nice, cozy little home. But he doesn't. I think he realizes there's a danger even in that. So what does he do? He gets up and spends the next 35 years walking around northern India. And as far as we know, never had a permanent address ever again. In Taoism, too, which most of you may know, Taoism in China, which was kind of the philosophical Taoism that we associate with Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu, was kind of getting its start right around the same time the Buddha was doing his stuff in India. Taoism, too, which had this big influence on Buddhism. Once Buddhism came to China, would greatly form Chan Buddhism. Daoism makes this big deal of home leaving also. In fact, in Taoism, the emphasis is on being a perpetual wanderer. You wander on the way. The way meaning Tao, or the Tao meaning the way, the path. So the destination is not what's important. The path is the destination. The journey is everything. Not hanging on to anything. In fact, that's what, in case any of you saw me bring it, I got a prop for my talk. This is not a medication in case I get really nervous. Although I could take it, I suppose. Some of you may know I'm a Chinese medical practitioner, and Chinese herbs have these way cool names. Purple frost, or restore left kidney, or frigid extremities formula. This one is called Free and Easy Wanderer, and which is a great name. It has saved many a relationship. And the name comes directly out of the inner chapters of Chuang Tzu. Chuang Tzu was one of the great Taoist philosophers after Lao Tzu. And in the 15th chapter of his inner chapters, he writes, "A person of the way has no fixed abode. He is a free and easy wanderer." Same type of thing. In Taoism, the idea is that this wandering, this is our true life. So we might as well be happy with it. Be a free and easy wanderer. Taoists also say that the great way, this is interesting because this shows up later on in Buddhist writings, the great way is not difficult, nor is it far removed. It starts at your doorstep. All you have to do is be willing to leave home. I think that's pretty significant. So apparently, the bumper sticker has it correct. Not all who wander are lost. So truth of the matter is, we're always leaving home. So there's no permanent fixed home in anything. This is a core teaching in Buddhism. No permanent home. Not in the world. Not in ideas. Concepts, certainly not in the self. There is no place to go, nothing to do. There is only the path. As Pema Chodron frequently points out, we are in a state of perpetual free fall with no hope of ever having solid ground under our feet. So if this is true, the essential question then becomes, can we be okay with this? Our tendency is not to be okay, right? We don't trust that. We try to grab hold of something, like somebody falling into white water caught in an avalanche. You try to grab hold of something. Seems like the right thing to do, and yet survival trainers will tell you that what you do to survive is you let go. But we don't. We usually freak out. Reminds me of a movie that I saw with my kids years ago. Kind of a, not a great movie. I think it was Journey to the Center of the Earth with Brendan Fraser. And there's a point where they fall into this pit, which is going to bring them to the center of the earth, apparently. And they're screaming as they're falling. And then the scene ends. And then the next scene comes up, and they're still falling. But this time they're like, they're like falling, and they're like talking. And at some point they remember that they're falling, and they freak out again. They start screaming. I think this is my life. So, However, because we're in a state of free fall, because we have no solid ground beneath our feet, does this mean that there's no such thing as homes or that we shouldn't enjoy them? Of course not. Homes, things do exist. And we can inhabit them for a little while. It's just that they're only temporary. They're like grass huts. The minute you build them, they're already sprouting weeds, which will soon overtake them, and they just dissolve back into the earth. So we eventually have to leave any home we make. So it's good we don't get attached to them. So we realize we're already homeless. We're always leaving home. We always have been, always will be. The problem isn't that we're always leaving home. The problem, I think, is that we refuse to recognize and accept this very simple fact. And I think this is a core element of Buddhist teaching. I think this is what is summed up in the teaching of the three marks of existence. Everything is impermanent. There's no permanent fixed self. And because of that, you can find no permanent satisfaction by holding on to things that are in themselves impermanent and always changing. So this also is expressed in the first two of the Four Noble Truths, that dissatisfaction exists, suffering in some interpretation, suffering exists, and that this arises from attachment to things that cannot, of their nature, provide permanent satisfaction. Pretty straightforward. So the question is, can we be okay with this? Can we be a wanderer on the way? Can we be okay without having solid ground beneath our feet or the hope that we ever will have solid ground beneath our feet? Since we're already leaving home, and that's kind of a no-brainer, we don't really have any choice in that. That's already happening. So really the choice hinges, how do we leave home? How can we be okay with this? So what is true home leaving? Well, I think there's a true home leaving mind, a home leaving mind. Then there's kind of the false home leaving, which that's usually what we do. We usually do it a lot, and it's the cause of much of our suffering. And what I mean by false home leaving is when we're leaving home, but we're not aware that we're doing it, so it causes us distress. Something's not right. We just kind of check out in those kind of situations. We're not paying attention to the fact that there's no solid ground beneath our feet. Delusion. Or we resist home leaving. That's common. I frequently find myself hanging onto the door jamb for dear life. I don't want to leave home. You know, it's nice and cozy there. I got all my stuff there. You know, maybe it's too cold outside. Whatever. There's lots of reasons why we don't leave home. Or, strangely, conversely, we run away from home. You know, home is scary. Home is a bad job, you know, that or a good job that we just get bored with. Home is something that we, for whatever reason, don't like and think there's something better out there and that that'll fix our lives. So we leave home for that reason. We're not really leaving home. We're just looking for a change of address that we hope will be better. That's a suffering in its own right, right? So this is what we kind of have to be careful about. We're always trying to make a new home of places, of things, of relationships, ideas. We even try to make a home, perhaps, of Buddhism. And think, oh, this will be my new home. This will be nice and comfortable. Everything will be okay now that I'm a Buddhist. Is that true?
Yeah, actually.
See, this is why he's a goofball. So So I think this is why Dogen says what he does when addressing an assembly of monks who've already gone through shuke, already gone through home-leaving ceremony. Because home-leaving, true home-leaving, doesn't have anything to do with the external aspect of leaving home, going through a ceremony, donning the robes, having the bowls, all that. And it's not just, true home-leaving, it's not just for monks or nuns or priests. It has nothing to do with shaved heads, nothing to do with robes. And in fact, to get caught up with all that is a perfect example of false home-leaving. True home-leaving is open to everyone. So what is true home-leaving? Well, I think Dogen states it pretty clearly. You know, again, I'll read it. When someone learns what a Buddha is and drops off what that person is holding on to, such a person is, in this way, an excellent example of leaving home life behind and accepting the precepts. This applies to everyone. Even the Buddha. No, the Buddha learns what the Buddha is. Of course, Dogen's not the only teacher to express this, nor was he the first. Shirto Chi Chien in the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage says, "Perishable or not, the original master is present, not dwelling south or north, east or west, ... Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk. Innocent." All we have to do is be willing to leave home. Relax, let go, drop body and mind, rest in just this, hold it lightly, then let it go. Open your hands, let it go. Hold the next thing lightly, let it go. Hold the next thing lightly, let it go, over and over again. Endlessly. Continuous practice. It's as simple as breathing. In fact, we breathe this way, right? You don't have any choice. You know, we're not like... you know, it's... You breathe in lightly, it's held, let go. You know, it's just coming and going. That's what we do. So why is it so damn hard? So I think the central importance of home leaving in Buddhism, and I think this is the essence of our practice really, is this continuous home leaving with openness, curiosity, lightness, compassion. It's what we do when we're on the cushion. It's what we do as we go about our daily life. Nothing special. It's just doing it continuously. Occasionally, life helps us with our practice in this way and lends a hand, kind of allowing us to experience a true home leaving of sorts. And when these experiences happen, they can have a profound effect on us and a far-reaching influence in our life. They can inspire us. They can encourage us. They can help us in our practice. They show us what's possible. We can be open to these things. They happen to us all the time. This is nothing special. Although sometimes they happen in quite unexpected ways. And what I'm talking about are those situations in life where you are just there. You're just completely present in what is. You're not trying to hang on to anything. You're not grasping for anything. You're not shutting down. I suppose sometimes people call this, you know, being in the flow. Being at one with anything. Great beauty has the ability to do this. You know, awe and wonder have this ability to do this. Love and compassion, unconditional love, which I am guessing everyone in this room has felt for someone, something, someplace, at least once, or been on hopefully the receiving end of that kind of unconditional love. You know, there's no separation, there's no holding on, there's just this wonderful this. Interestingly, sometimes danger or fear can bring this state of being in, you know, where you kind of are leaving home, perhaps in a scary way, and you have no choice but to just accept it, and something opens up. Forty years ago, to this day, this is what I alluded to at the beginning of my talk, I had such an experience, and it had a profound effect on me. And it had to do with falling through the ice on a day like this. And when I was a kid, we lived not too far from this lake. It was about a mile away from where we lived. And my mom was always telling us, stay awake from the lake. You know, especially don't go on the ice, ever. Of course, that's just, you know, an invitation to a kid, you know, right? So, what I did on this particular day is a friend and myself and my sister and her friend, we had gone down to this lake, and it was the first really cold day, sub-zero day of the winter. And the lake had been freezing and then thawing and freezing and thawing for some time, for a couple weeks. And the lake would get a thin skimming of ice on it, and then the wind would come up and be a little warmer, and all the ice would break up and get pushed to the south end of the lake, resulting eventually in one half of the lake being fairly solid, thick ice with a ridge of ice across it at that point, and the other half of the lake being now newly frozen under sub-zero temperature on a really calm night. So the ice was perfectly smooth and perfectly clear. So we were down at the lake and found out that if you throw a rock on this ice, it makes this most amazing sound. Whoa, 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 whoa. Very cool. So we thought this would be really neat to go out further, walking along this ice ridge, and throw rocks out onto the lake. So I filled my pockets with rocks, which proved to be a fateful decision. So we walk along this ridge, and we're throwing rocks out there on the lake, and it's making all these very cool sounds. My sister and her friend get bored with this whole shenanigans and think it's just foolish nothing, so she heads home, taking the role of kind of a surrogate mother, saying, don't go on that ice. So I'm looking at this ice, which is black, and you could see through, you could see bubbles trapped in it. And there was something mesmerizing about it. I could not resist. So I step out onto this ice, and I walk. It's very slick. I'm walking very, very carefully. And I walk out maybe about 20 feet, and all of a sudden, all these little cracks started to appear. And it was like one of those things from the cartoon, you know, where the cartoon character looks up and, like, holds up a sign, oh, no! And poof, right through the ice I went with pockets full of rocks. So I went right down to the bottom of the lake and kind of bounced off the bottom and came up and now hit my head on the underside of the ice. Apparently, because there was a current in the lake, I had come up somehow underneath the thick part of the ice. and I couldn't find the hole. Now, one of the things about being in water, I've always hated being in water, and I would never open up my eyes in water. But interestingly, I opened up my eyes this time. And so I'm like looking around. And you can't see anything, but you know, it's just kind of this murky green. But you can see where the light is, you know. So in this case, the adage in near-death experiences, go towards the light. This was actually good advice, really. So now I'm going to give you a little bit of background to this experience because this is significant to what happens later. So I'm just going to leave me trapped under the ice for a minute. I did not have a real easy childhood, like a lot of people. It was difficult. My dad was killed in a car accident very early in my life, a block away from home, actually. And it was something that we heard happen, we saw it happen, and it was it really had a profound effect on our family. Left my mom with four kids under the age of four and pregnant with the fourth one. No car, no job. We were therefore very poor after that, and my mom had a really, really difficult time with this. And the result was that it was not a very happy childhood. It was a very difficult home life. And it was a home life that I couldn't deal with. I couldn't run away from. I couldn't fight back. So I left home by creating a new one in my head, basically. I created kind of a fantasy world in my head, something that I would become very good at doing for the rest of my life. You know, loving the kind of ivory tower, getting lost in concepts and ideas. Well, as you can imagine, for any of you that have done this, this creates a whole new set of problems. I was like Mr. Duffy in James Joyce, The Dubliners, you know, where it's like I now lived a short distance from my body. I was like so much in my head, I wasn't in my body or in life, so to speak, most of the time. You know, part of this, you know, showed up in school where I was constantly getting in trouble for being a daydreamer, you know, but that's putting it very mildly. I was really checked out in a lot of ways. So when I was a kid, there was this constant undertow of certainly dissatisfaction, suffering, fear, a lot of fear. And this kind of ruled my life. It was like a constant, steady state. I was horribly shy. I didn't know how to interact with most of the world. So I'd keep retreating to this made-up world in my head. When I fell through the ice and hit the bottom, came up and couldn't find the hole, it was like all that stopped. And I'm not quite sure how. I kind of, you know, figured out, you know, take the rocks out of your pockets for one thing. So I dumped the rocks out, and I did, obviously, find the hole and get out of the ice. And as I was trying to get out of the ice, you know, the ice was continuing to break. And my friend, who is now practically paralyzed with fear and freaking out, it was no help whatsoever. But you know, and back in those days, they didn't have the boards strapped to the signs that say thin ice. They might have had a sign that said thin ice, but they probably didn't see fit to put a board there, figuring if you were stupid enough to not pay attention to the sign, you're on your own. So there was, I managed to get out, and I was like laughing. You know, and it wasn't that I thought it was funny, it was like I felt so light. It was like as if everything had just stopped. That whole world in my head just like stopped. And I got out and I felt, it's hard to describe, I felt absolutely wonderful. I was not afraid. I was not not somewhere else. I was very much present. Everything was so clear to me. Everything was so real for the first time in a long, long, long time. Walked home, Fortunately, it was so cold that my clothes froze almost instantly, kind of creating a candy shell. This is what it's like to feel like an M&M, basically. Had it been a bit warmer, I probably would have been at risk for getting hypothermia. But when I get home, my sister, who has had this premonition now that something awful has happened, she's up at the window on the second story of the house. Said, "What happened?" And I said, "Oh, I fell through the ice." And it's like, if I fell through the ice, my mom would kill me. You know, this is something, you don't come home and say, "Mom, I fell through the ice," just like you said I would. So I say to my sister, I said, "Throw a bunch of clothes, some dry clothes, down the laundry chute into the basement. I'll come in." My mom would have been sitting at the kitchen door by the back hall where the stairs go to the basement, which she would usually do like on a Saturday afternoon, kind of, smoking and drinking Dr. Pepper and talking on the phone. And like any kid knows, with enough interference, you could get anything past your mom. You know, you always ask for stuff when they're on the phone, right? So my sister throws my dry clothes down the chute, and she comes down, and then she's like, you know, talking to my mom, like, "Mom, what you doing?" You know, kind of a thing. And I get in, and I run downstairs, get changed into some dry clothes, figuring that my mom would not remember what I was wearing when I left that day, so I'd be in the clear. So, of course, now I had this additional problem of what do I do with all these wet clothes. This was the day before dryers, you know. So in our basement at the time, we had these built-in cedar boxes. They actually looked like coffins. They're about 6 feet long, and they had this like lid, this really heavy lid. And there was four of them, and we used them as like toy boxes when we were kids. And I thought, well, I'll take all my stuff out, throw it in one of my sister's boxes, and lay my clothes out in this to dry. And then when they're dry, then I'll just throw them in the dirty laundry, and that'll be the end of it. So I did that. And but for the next 3 days or so, it was like a transformed world. This experience left me for some time feeling just very in life and out of my head. I was not shy. I was not scared. I was not having this internal suffering. Now, it eventually wore off, and things were kind of back to normal for years to come. But, and this is a significant thing, is that it left me with the realization that suffering, at least my suffering, was not so much a matter of circumstance as it is a matter of mind. And that my suffering, in this case, was largely connected to something that I had done with my state of mind. I had made this home, so to speak, of a mind state that was clearly creating a lot of suffering for me. And when I fell through the ice, I had no choice but to just let it go. And that carried forward for a few days. And even though I started grabbing hold of things later on and putting them back in place and creating my own internal world, it stuck with me that it's possible to change this. So this was to send me on endless forays to the library, looking for books on, you know, religion. I went to a Catholic grade school. I was an altar boy at the time, believe it or not. Always wearing robes. You know? So I go to the alternative religion section in the school library, which it was a Catholic school, so alternative religion meant Lutherans. But there was a book by Thomas Merton. What it was doing in a Catholic grade school, I have no idea. But so I found that was really cool. And eventually I kind of explored other aspects of Christianity, read the Bible, explored Judaism, Islam, and, you know, when I discovered things of the Far East. I mean, this was the 60s, you know. So, that just really opened up a whole world. Found Ram Dass' book, Be Here Now. I thought, that's it. All you have to do is fall through the ice, and you can be here now. But here was now kind of maps, instructions on how you could do this without falling through the ice, without putting yourself in harm's way. And this eventually led me to Buddhism, eventually to Zen, eventually to Minnesota Zen Center, which ironically is on a lake. So I'd be thinking about this. Every Rohatsu, you know, we have our little breaks on the porch, and I'd be... So, to finish up my story about falling through the ice, the rest is, as they say, history as far as my coming here. There was kind of a humorous epilogue to the incident. As you remember, I had left all my wet clothes in this cedar box. And the following spring, I had completely forgotten about this. And the following spring, my mom would get the spring cleaning bug, and she would spring clean things very, very thoroughly. And us kids would try to get out of the houses as soon as we can before we got tapped to have to be the one to assist her that day. That meant a 12 to 15 hour stint. And so I actually happened to be the one to help her with the spring cleaning of the basement, one of the first rooms to be cleaned in the house. And so we are going through this cleaning, and we get to the point where she starts opening up these boxes, and then it suddenly hits me. I have forgotten these clothes in there. And so again, it's like one out of those, like right out of the cartoon, you know. It's like, as she's lifting the box, I'm like, no. And she opens it up, and there's all my clothes, like laid out. And again, it looks like something from a sci-fi movie. It's like, you know, like where the person is like disintegrated, and their clothes are there, but there's nothing in them. And so I'm looking at essentially myself, in this coffin-like box. And it was kind of an interesting little epilogue to this whole incident. And she, of course, you know, the fear comes back in me. And, you know, so she turns, she's like, what are these doing there? And so I answered with what would become, you know, a great Zen response, although it didn't really come that way at the time, and my mom didn't appreciate it. I don't know. So, but amazingly, she never... Anyway, she said, get these out of here. I mean, they had like mushrooms growing on them. They were like moldy and had to be thrown out. So, so the reason I wanted to share that with you is because it's a good example how these things come up in life where we have the opportunity, sometimes we don't have the choice, where you just leave home. You just have to let go. So I think that my conclusion about all this is that home leaving is not the beginning of the Buddhist path. I think it is the Buddhist path. We're always leaving home. So we might as well do it with awareness, openness, lightness, curiosity, joy when possible, but always with compassion. And because we're continuously leaving home, this becomes continuous practice. Our continuous practice being continuously okay with that without having the solid ground beneath our feet. Being okay with that perpetual free fall. So I think this is what Dogen is saying in Shuke, and I don't think he's just saying it for the monks or the nuns or the priests. So again, when someone learns what a Buddha is and drops off whatever that person is holding on to, such a person is, in this way, an excellent example of leaving home life behind and accepting the precepts. Hongjer, one of our Zen ancestors, says the same thing, I think very beautifully. A person of the way fundamentally does not dwell anywhere. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountain's foundation. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. The clouds part and the mountains appear. The moon sets and the water is cool. Each bit of autumn contains vast interpenetration without bounds. So, thank you. Well, I think we have a little time for any questions or comments if anyone wishes to. How is our friend doing on the porch? Cool. So, any thoughts, any questions, any comments? Yes, well.
You mentioned about we can end up having Zen or anything else as a home if we feel comfortable. If we feel comfortable, should that be a warning sign to us that we're doing something wrong?
No, I don't think so. I don't think there's any problem with feeling comfortable. I think that trying to hang on to it can be a problem, but enjoying it isn't. I think Buddhism, I was having this conversation with someone the other day, so like, oh, you Buddhist, you know, Buddha is such a bummer. It's like you can't enjoy anything. You know, like as if like detachment means like not enjoying. But I think Buddhism allows us to enjoy things with greater enjoyment because half of us are not like hanging on to this enjoyment, already thinking of the next thing, or fearing what's going to happen when it goes away, or comparing it to something else that we enjoy that's similar. So I think that, you know, being comfortable is fine, just but being able to be okay with whatever the next thing is, and the next thing. You know, that whole, you know, be here now idea is certainly good advice, but maybe what should be pointed out from time to time is that to be here now means you have to let go of the now of a moment ago. You know, so it's this continuous practice. And I think being okay with that brings with it its own comfort. Its own comfort. So enjoy, be comfortable.
Chris, you mentioned own leaving versus running away. Can you talk more about that?
I think home leaving is something that we're already doing because the home is itself is always changing, always dissolving, always reforming to something else. Home in this sense is a concept we make of that and then try to hang on to it. So home leaving is kind of the statement of the fact we do it. There is, as I mentioned, there's a number of ways that we might deal with that. And one of the ways we deal with that fact is we try to make a new home someplace else. And once we become aware that this present home is not doing it for us, we run away from that home to find a new address. And so running away from home is not a true home leaving. It's not being okay with the fact that things are changing. It's looking for something else that we hope will be better, more stable, more safe, more pleasurable, or whatever it is.
What about more warm?
Yeah. Yeah, that's another reason why I was thinking of home leaving. I thought, you know, this time of year, you know, half the population leaves home, go to warmer climes. Yeah. So, yes, Ted.
Nice talk, Chris.
Oh, thank you, Ted.
Hello, how are you?
Thank you.
Thank you,
Ted.
Really explain Marty.
Yeah, I haven't even begun to get to that, so. No.
So in this impermanent moment, the earth holds us up. Our bones support us.
Yeah. For a while. And it's enough.
Appreciate your comments about running away and that's not a true home meeting? Because, you know, I thought about that quite a bit. And the next place that you go, then you address, like, you are still there.
Yeah.
And I think that brought us a little more hope for me. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I have to contend with that on an ongoing basis myself. That's my tendency. I'm so good at creating these conceptual worlds in my head. It's very easy for me to create a new world to replace the old one and not even be aware I'm doing it. And I think religion and spirituality can be an easy haven for this kind of home leaving. And we have a hard time seeing it because we think we're doing something so noble, you know, because it's religious or it's spiritual. But it's real easy to make a home, a false home out of this new thing, you know, the spirituality, you know. You know, and of course, Zen is famous for all kinds of stories and comments about, you know, don't make a thing out of Buddhism. Don't make it yet another home that you become attached to. This continuous practice, this continuous home leaving, is, in my opinion, I think, kind of the central message here. Yes.
Do you think the act of you walking out on the to the thing, the start of your intentional home, or is this something just happens?
I think it's just something that happened stupidly, which in my case was somewhat natural at the time. But I mean, maybe, you know, in the vast scheme of things, I have no idea. Maybe, you know, it's kind of like one of those things that was just, you know, meant to happen or whatever. You know, there's no accidents. But, you know, it was certainly an opportunity. I probably help things along, you know. Putting my rocks in my pocket were, you know, one of the ways I helped that along. So it's I wouldn't recommend it, by the way. But it's amazing, you know, a lot of people have those experiences in life, and it alters them. I've met many people who have shared with me such experiences. Some of them have been very scary, very dangerous situations, you know, veterans from battlefields, or people getting a diagnosis of cancer, or having a sudden loss of a loved one, or a job, or a relationship. And it's not to say that those things aren't horrible, you know, when they happen. They're very painful. And it's not to make light of them. But people often said, you know, there's something that came with that. It kind of shook something loose in a way that I had no choice but to just be with it. Just be with it. And I think that's our practice. Yes?
I know it's an article of faith, but do you really think it's possible for a person to be comfortable with nothing solid?
I think...
I didn't hear what you said. Yeah. Said, you know, it's an article of faith, you know, you've got the Buddha as the model, but do you think it's possible to actually be comfortable with nothing solid? Are we just better at creating more open models? Ultimately.
Well, and I think that's what sets Buddhism apart from so many other religions or philosophies, is that I think many, many people in the world have realized that this world is fraught with impermanence. And although a lot of us will go to great lengths to trying to create our world just so, get the job, get the money, get the house, you know, all that kind of stuff, and try to hold it, I think most of us realize that that ultimately does not work. So what do? You know, as human beings, is we create other worlds, you know, metaphysics. You know, we create a afterworld, an afterlife, a heaven, or someplace else that will be our solid, permanent home at some point. And, you know, that's cool. I think that brings people a lot of comfort. And that's one way of dealing with pain and suffering. It's the idea that there will be a home. This home might be a problem, but this next home will be it. You know, the Buddha kind of did not go there. He, whenever pressed into questions of metaphysics, he always responded with silence, or he said that this would not profit you. You know, so I think that what the Buddha proposes is that, you know, as far as we can tell with our direct experience, this is what we got, and it's always changing. There's no solid ground beneath our feet. So if you want to really get to the point where you can believe that there's something out there that will be solid eventually, that's great if it does it for you. But, you know, that yearning for it, that constant looking ahead to that, you know, that carries with it a certain amount of problems too, because you're not really then here. So it kind of, it's something that I think is difficult to be okay with that, but I do think it is possible to be comfortable with it. And for me, I think that there are certainly times in my life where I feel like I don't have a choice with it, so I just am comfortable with it.
Well, I mean, it's always nice to know that there's resources that when you fall through rocks, that you can have some sort of instinct which will get you out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people have had an experience where they've been amazed at how well they responded, which is probably just the quality of your concepts drop away and you're completely present. And I just wonder, is it really true? I mean, it's definitely a faith of Buddhism, but is it really possible that one can be present? And being present is probably what is, you know, what you're talking about ultimately, truly being present. And you can have the experience of it, but can you stay there?
Yeah.
Can you really be comfortable?
Well, I think that's what the Buddha says, you know, don't take my word for it. Find out for yourself if this works for you.
I also think, too, that not struggling so hard is exactly the same as being comfortable. And that maybe that's enough, right? That just stopping struggling so hard against what it feels like to leave home or struggling against realities we don't want to accept or whatever. But I don't know, maybe it's like settling in for the long haul, and like it's cushy and comfortable, even though it's really scary, isn't the right thing, but just thinking less about struggling.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, taking things as they are, whatever they happen to be, certainly better allows us to work with them. You know. So I think maybe we'll call it a day. And again, thank you for listening and for your comments.